start thanking the seminar's organizer and also Amit for the kind invitation to visit the PI. It's a pleasure to be here giving this talk. So I will be talking about a couple of papers I've done in collaboration with Juan Maldacena. So the aim of this project, of all these papers, is to compute gluon scattering amplitudes of a very particular theory, namely n equals 4 super Yani Mills in 4 dimensions. The reason to study this theory is that on one hand, it can give some non-trivial information about more realistic gauge theories, like for instance, QCD, that is what we would like eventually to understand, but at the same time, is much more tractable. Yeah, I don't know why. Okay. So this tractability has to do with two things. So on one hand, with coupling, perturbative computations are much simpler than in QCD because of the high degree of symmetries of n equals 4. On the other hand, at a strong coupling, we have the ADS-CFT duality, and we hope to understand this theory through understanding a weakly coupled string sigma model. So what we want to do is to put these two things together and use the ADS-CFT duality in order to understand as much as possible about scattering amplitudes of n equals 4 super Yani Mills. So the outline of the talk is, first I will start with some background material. Here I try to be slow, but you can slow me down or telling me that you are getting bored. So first we will see some gauge theory results, and then we will see the string theory setup for computing these quantities, and we will show how this string theory prescription works for a very particular case. Then we will make some progress by restricting ourselves to some special kinematical configurations. And then finally, we will end up with some conclusions. And please, during the talk, stop me as many times as you want. Just ask me as many questions as you want. I don't mind if I don't cover all what I want to say. I just want you to understand most of it. So just stop me, and that's perfect. OK. So gauge theory amplitudes in n equals 4 have been studied by many people, in particular by Bernd Dixon and Smirnov. So what they did is they focused in gluon scattering amplitudes of n equals 4 super Yani Mills in 4 dimensions with SUN gauge group with very large n. It turns out that if you are interested in the planar limit, in the limit of a very large number of colors, it's very useful to consider amplitudes in the so-called color decomposed form. In this form, we see that the color extractor, these TA are just generators of SUN in the joint representation, the color extractor separates from the kinematical dependence. And these authors focused on this guy that is called the leading color-ordered endpoint amplitudes at L loops. So each color extractor is multiplied by a coefficient, by a factor that depends on the kinematic, and we focus on this factor. Here, N denotes the number of gluons that we are scattering, and L denotes the loop order that we are considering. So we focus on this guy here. Now, suppose that you go to some QST book and you want to compute this amplitude, then you start adding up Feynman diagrams or whatever, then you find infinity. The problem is that these amplitudes, as all the amplitudes of massless gauge theories in 4 dimensions, are infrared divergent. So in order to define them properly, we need to introduce a regulator. What people usually do is they go away from 4 dimensions, so they study the amplitudes in 4.01 dimensions or something like that. So you go to 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. This is a little bit misleading because epsilon is negative. You could have called it that 4 plus 2 epsilon, but people use this. Then your amplitudes are finite, but the price you have to pay is that the amplitudes will have an explicit dependence on this parameter epsilon. And the infrared divergences manifest themselves as poles in this 1 over epsilon. Now, furthermore, we see that we can focus on so-called MHB amplitudes. I don't know, do you know what an MHB amplitude is? Maybe. Well, so basically, you are scattering gluons. Oh. You know, gluons is a massless guy in 4 dimensions. So it has, helicity plus or minus. So you are scattering something with all pluses, but 2 minuses. And this is called a MHB amplitude. It turns out that if you put pluses here, this is 0. So the first non-trivial amplitude is this one, and we focus on this one. And it turns out that it's very convenient to factor out the 3-level amplitude and to define a normalized amplitude like this. Any questions? So based in explicit perturbative computations, Bern, Dixon, and Smirnov noticed that they could write an ansatz for the logarithm of the amplitude that worked to all loops, or at least to all loops that they were aware of. So the ansatz looks as follows. So now I will explain you what the different pieces of the ansatz are. So first notice that this is an ansatz for the logarithm of the amplitude. Then you have a function f that is called the cusp anomalous dimension that characterizes the leading divergent terms, the terms that go with 1 over epsilon squared. Here lambda is the coupling constant and mu is the infrared regulator scale. This Si plus 1 is just if you have 2 gluons of momenta Ki and Ki plus 1, this Si is simply Ki plus Ki plus 1 squared. You have another function, G, that characterizes the subleading divergent terms, the terms that go with 1 over epsilon squared. And the powerful thing about the BDS ansatz is that the finite piece, according to them, is just a simple function that is the same as this function here, is the cusp anomalous dimension, times the finite piece of the one loop amplitude. So just the one loop finite piece. So somehow, if you take the one loop and you exponentiate it, and you multiply it by the cusp anomalous dimension, sorry, you multiply first and you exponentiate later, then you get the amplitude to all values of the coupling constant. So by now, we know that this ansatz is fine for 4 and 5 gluons, but it's not correct for more than 5 gluons. But anyway, it has been, I think anyway, this formula is quite powerful, even if it is not true. Now, what we want to do, so it's like stimulating to have a formula because you want to prove it right or wrong. So like if you put a formula, people will work on that. So it's good to have a formula even if it's not right.
Sorry? This function f, that's correct.
So what they gave was some general structure up to 2 functions, f and g. And these 2 functions, f and g, in principle, they have to be computed order by order. But, well, let me just tell you briefly that there are methods of integrability in ADS-CFT that allow you to compute this f to all values of the coupling, but not for g. So g is not very well known. So what we want to do now is to study this thing at a strong coupling. So suppose that this formula is right, then you are allowed to put lambda equals 10 to the 47, and you should be able to test whether this is right or not. Now, if lambda is equal to 10 to the 47, we can use the Eddie-SCFT duality, and we can compute such amplitudes by considering strings on Eddie-S5. Now, I told you that in the gauge theory, amplitudes are infrared divergent. They will be also infrared divergent in the string side of the computation. So what we do in order to regularize them is we do the following. So consider first ADS5 in Poincaré coordinates. So it's given by this metric. Then you put a brain at some radial distance, see infrared, very large. Once you have put that brain by hand, you have asymptotic states that are open strings ending on this brain. And then you consider the scattering of these open strings. So that's what we do at a strong coupling. We put a brain, we have open strings ending on this brain, and we consider the scattering of these open strings. Sorry?
Depending, if you consider the law of the amplitude is divergent, but it's a negative divergence. So if you compute the exponential of that, it's, but notice that in a string, like at a strong coupling, you naturally compute the log of the amplitude rather than the amplitude. But indeed, I mean, it's easy if you consider the amplitude itself. So you have this problem. Now, it turns out that it's useful not to see the problem in terms of this original ADS space, but to consider the problem in terms of some dual ADS space. So you start from these variables, you do some change of variables. In particular, you go from this C to 1 over C, and you call that R. And then the problem reduces to a minimal area problem that I will describe for you. So as I was telling you, you can start from the original ADS space. You perform, you don't have to know the name, but you perform a t-duality on these 3+1 coordinates, and you perform an inversion of this radial coordinate, and you end up with a dual ADS space. So the nice thing about this dual ADS space is that the worksheet that we were considering before has very nice boundary conditions that I will explain you now. So now, this worksheet is a worksheet that ends at some value of this little r equals r squared over c infrared in some polygon. And this polygon is formed as follows. Suppose you want to scatter 4 particles with momenta k1, k2, k3, and k4. Then at some fixed value of little r, for each particle of momentum k mu, you draw a segment proportional to k mu. So here we draw a segment k1, k2, k3, k4. Then you concatenate the segments according to the ordering of the scattering that you were considering. And then you look for the minimal surface that ends in such polygon. So that's the exercise we need to do. Notice that as gluons are massless, then all these segments are Lie-like segments. Also, due to momentum conservation, this is a closed polygon. So we have a closed polygon of Lie-like segments, and our worksheet has to end on this polygon. Now, notice that as we have introduced the regulator, so this brain was at some finite distance, C infrared. So this C infrared is very large but finite. Then this worksheet is not ending at R equals 0, but is ending at R squared over C infrared, which is bigger than 0. So our worksheet doesn't end at the boundary of this ADS space, but ends at a small value of the radial distance. Now, as you move DC infrared to infinity, the boundary of the worksheet moves towards the boundary of ADS. And the computation that you have to do is exactly the same computation as if you were to use the ADS-CFT duality to compute the expectation value of a Wilson loop given by this sequence of light-light segments. Lorentzian. So these are light-light segments. So this is like 3 plus 1. And this is 3 plus 1. So it's like not, so sometimes when people consider like the circular Wilson loop.
I have an arbitrarily minimal area if I just take null surfaces going up from that polygon.
Well, yeah, that you can see that that is not minimal. I mean, the minimal here, they will stay at some value of R here. So actually, you can see, it's very simple. I don't want to enter much into detail. But for Chizky and Strassler, they use some kind of, their situation is completely different. But you can see that basically this distance here is proportional like to the Mandelstam variables, S and T, or the square root. So you have some, you could consider to try to put all these strings to the horizon directly, but that doesn't minimize the area.
Thank you.
So our final, any other question? So our final prescription, how you should compute the scattering amplitudes at the strong coupling is as follows. What we are telling is that the leading exponential behavior of the endpoint scattering amplitude is given through this relation, and for this we use the ADS-CFT duality, is given by the area of a minimal surface that ends on a sequence of light-light segments on the boundary. And these light-light segments are given by the momenta of the gluons that you are scattering. So that is the prescription. And that's what I want you to remember. Yes.
All momentum configurations, or you just can choose particular momentum?
No, it's just an exclusive amplitude. So it's just one particular momentum configuration.
How you can get to the point of summing over all momentum configurations? Because that's what reality needs, right?
That's true. That would be very nice. No, this you have to think about this as a building block for like an infrared safe quantity, let's say.
Is there any
so I don't know.
That's an unsolved problem, or because you never prepare a gluon.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know if anyone who has done this in detail from here, like from these building blocks. So you can consider the jets functions, right? Correlation functions of jets or something like that, and there should be some connection. But you would like, in principle, to start from here, then to sum over a lot of configurations, and then to get infrared safe quantities. But I don't know if anyone who has done that in detail.
You have to, right?
Eventually, you have to.
You have no free gluons.
That's correct, yeah. So you had some jets or something like that.
But even, okay, well, maybe you should go on. But even jets don't correspond to a particular gluon momentum configuration.
Well, actually, here, notice the following. When I told gluon at a strong coupling, we don't distinguish between any member of the supermultiplier. So it's any particle. So if you're considering, well, I didn't want to enter that much into details. But actually, if
that still doesn't help.
Any massless particle will have this leading behavior at the strong coupling. Any member of the n equals 4 supermultiplier. Even scalars or fermions. Because the information about that will enter as subleading corrections to this formula.
So maybe there's hope to prepare.
Right. So maybe that makes it easier to use. Exactly. So something I wanted to say, but it's half answered here, is that notice that in particular you may have prefactors here, and for instance, these prefactors may depend, let's say, on the helicity of the gluons or in the kind of particles that you are scattering.
So this is pretty universal result. So, but I wanted to
present this just as for scattering of gluons at a strong cap. Any other question? Okay, so even if you didn't understand much of what I've been saying, the only thing I want you to keep is the following, is that if I give you many gluons with momenta K1, K2, etc., then you construct the polygon. Somehow you look for this minimal surface, you exponentiate this minimal surface as shown, and this will give you the scattering amplitude at a strong cap. So that's all the problem we need to solve. So for instance, to see how this works, one can consider the easiest example, and it's the example of the scattering of two particles, K1 and K3, going into two other particles, K2 plus K4. And for simplicity, we will focus in the simplest case, that is the case in which the two Mandelstam variables are equal. So in that case, the polygon that I've been talking about, this polygon here, has this form. So this is y0, this is time, and this is y1 and y2, and these four are the four Lie-Lie segments. Then we need to find the minimal surface that ends on this polygon. So here you are either very lucky or very good, and we are very lucky. So we just try to try in Mathematica, and our first attempt was the following, and this indeed turns out to be the minimal surface that ends on this polygon. So this is the time y0. Here I am choosing these edges at y1 equals plus 1 and minus 1, and y2 equals plus and minus 1. So this is the surface that ends on this polygon. It is sometimes, this is the radial coordinate of ADS, and this is the time. This is in Poincaré coordinates. So it is sometimes nice to consider embedding coordinates. So in embedding coordinates, you think of ADS5 as a surface embedded in R2,4. So here it's minus y minus 1, minus y0, plus y1 to y4 equals to minus 1. So that is what we have. And in terms of embedding coordinates, this surface looks very simple. It's just this. Notice that you have six coordinates with 1, 2, 3, 4 constraints, gives you a bidimensional surface, and this is the surface we are looking for. Now, there is something nice, is that once you have noticed that you can write the solution in terms of embedding coordinates, you have a group of isometries, SO2,4, that changes, that acts linearly on these embedding coordinates. And this group of isometries allows you to start from a particular solution, as this one, and then to construct the most general solution we test different from T. Don't confuse this group of isometries related to this dual ADS space with the group of isometries of the original ADS space. These are two SO2,4 groups that we have at our disposal. So now that you have the most general solution, you can ask, okay, now let's take this solution, let's put it into the formula for the area, and let's compute the area. Any questions before I proceed?
Just have a very silly question. If you have many momentum,
yes,
in principle you can form many different kinds of momentum changing the way.
Well, right. So it's important. So, right. Very good question. So, remember that I told you that we consider one of these coefficients,
right? So, one of these coefficients will have a particular ordering. So, So K1, K2. So indeed, the full amplitude will have all the combinations. But if you focus on one, on the stripped color or leader or color ordered amplitude, then you will have a particular ordering. And that is the ordering that you are focusing on. Okay, so we have now the most general solution. We test different from T. So we can try to compute the area. Now notice that that if we put these edges and plus and minus one, in plus and minus one, this R is equal to zero. At the boundary. However, I told you today that this R had to be at some value that is larger than zero if we want the amplitude to be regularized. So if you naively plug this solution into the action in order to compute the area, you get an infinite answer. And that is indeed the case, has to be the case, because in setting R equals zero, it's like we have taken away the infrared regulator. So if we want to compute a meaningful answer, a finite answer, we need to reintroduce the infrared regulator. Now, I told you that what people usually do is they study the theory away from four dimensions. A little bit more precisely, they use what is called a dimensional reduction scheme. They start with n equals 1 in 10 dimensions, and then they dimensionally reduce to 4 minus 2 epsilon. So that is what gauge theory people do. But now notice that for integer d, this is exactly the low energy theory living on a dp brain, where p is d minus 1. So what we will do, so if you start with the usual ADS phi cross S5, you consider a D3 brain, and then you have a gauge theory living in four dimensions. We want to go away from four dimensions, so instead of a D3 brain, we consider a D3 minus 2 epsilon brain. And then we will simply do analytic continuation on this epsilon there. Now, so it turns out that this is the supergravity background, the near horizon limit of a D3 minus 2 epsilon brain, with this 2 plus epsilon here. And when you compute the action, you get the same action as before with a little factor 1 over r to the epsilon. That makes your integrals to converge. One can actually compute this ansatz, and this agrees precisely with the VDS ansatz that I told you about, once you plug the strong coupling limits for these functions. So we are quite confident that the VDS ansatz works for four gluons. Now, well, this was supposed to be the introduction, but maybe it was too fast. Or now, the question, yeah.
Yes.
Presumably, if you just did what you said before and imposed the
color, that's correct.
That's still fine.
Yes, that's still fine. But then you would have to find the solutions for that n in R equals some small value, right? And that, well, myself, I am not smart enough to do that at least. I mean, notice that this in the edges, this R is equal to zero. So you would like to find a classical solution that doesn't end in R equals zero, but ends in some R equals R cutoff or something like that. So indeed, that would give you a regular answer. I can even tell you what the answer will be, but I don't know how to find the classical solution for that. But in principle, yes, it would actually would be wonderful to find the classical solution that ends on some finite value of the radius. But I am not able to do that. So the most I can do is just is to find this classical solution and then to plug it into this new action to obtain a regular answer.
Now, one question we would like to answer is what about more than four gluons? So in particular, this SO2,4 symmetry that I was talking about tells you that the answer at the strong coupling is almost fixed to be the answer at one loop, so it's some known factor. But in principle, suppose that you have some polygon like this that ends at some points x1, x2, x3, x4, etc., and so on, then you can construct cross ratios that are quantities of this form, ij, kl, ik, jl. And then it turns out that if you can construct these cross ratios to the one loop answer, you can add any function of these cross ratios. And SO2,4 symmetries will not tell you anything about these new functions. So this is something that you have to compute. And in the second part of this talk, we will see how, at a strong coupling, we can compute these extra functions, let's say all the interesting stuff lies on this function for some particular cases. So do you have any questions before? Yes. Right, you don't have UV divergences in any quest 4.
On a related to other theories, there will be UV divergences?
In general, yes. Like in QCD, you have?
Yeah.
Yes. Awesome. So this tells you like about infrared divergences. Yes, like any notice is quite important. I told you that
this epsilon is negative. So you are going above four dimensions. If you were below four dimensions, then you would have UV divergences. So you don't have UV divergences because of that. So
supersymmetry.
In generic theories, you will have both.
And generic theories, they're indistinguishable in dimmer.
That's correct. That's correct. Well, they are hard to distinguish.
Well, they're hard to distinguish.
Yes. Absolutely. But on the other hand, in generic theories, dimensional regularization cures both of them.
Cures another problem.
Right. But that's true. You don't have the UV problem here in the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Quick question. Is it really useful, accessible to write this denial function in the exponent?
No, actually noticed that's a good point. Actually noticed that I gave the VDS answer as an answer for the log of the amplitude. And that's what I like to talk about. So in principle, there can be like other things of exponential order here.
I guess for MHP amplitudes may be okay to, I don't know, non-MHP. I mean, like if you take the log of the amplitude, also you have to worry about the delta functions, and so I'm not fully sure that how you can write. But that for sure at the strong coupling, you can write the full answer as the one loop plus some remainder function.
Well, notice
that it's not entirely, I mean, you have to be careful with writing a log as an exponent or something. I mean, because there are things of order epsilon here, and this, when you take the exponent, this epsilon here can hit this 1 over epsilon squared to give you finite pieces. So you have to be careful about that. So I think, yeah, so I prefer to see the VDS ansatz as an ansatz for the log of the amplitude. With dimensional regularization.
I mean, another thing you can say is that Kluchensky et al. At recoupling, they do separate out the MHV amplitude to all loops from the rest of the stuff, or to whatever loop order you're working with. And then the rest of the stuff is exactly invariant into this dual factor 2-4.
But you don't like to explain.
Well, as you say, I mean, you can. Whether you do it as a product or as a set, and then focus on bits of that. So all the anomalies contained.
Okay, so one question we want to ask for is whether we can make progress for more than four gluons. I mean, this
solution is nice, but yeah, it doesn't give me very much of an answer. In order to do that, unfortunately, it's very hard to find classical solutions to this problem. With like, actually, if you see Wilson loops at the strong coupling, people know some of them, but not a lot of them. So it's like there are not too many solutions that are known at the strong coupling. So in order to make progress, we will restrict ourselves to a very special kinematical configuration. The kinematical configuration is as follows. So we will consider Lie-like polygons in the Y1, Y2, Y0 plane in such a way that if you project the polygon to the Y1, Y2 plane, this is a polygon which circumscribes the unit circle. This seems to be quite weird, but it turns out that in that case, the equations of motion and boundary conditions are consistent with setting Y3 and Y0 equals 0. So the worksheet that will end on this polygon is effectively living in an ADS3 subspace of ADS5. You can see this thing in some other way. So basically, if you are considering ADS3, the boundary is a two-dimensional space. So morally, you are considering a two-dimensional scattering, for instance, in the cylinder. Now, consider a zigzag Wilson loop of 2n sides. Notice that now I am calling 2n the sides of the polygon instead of n. I was calling it n before. So we are in 1+1 dimensions, so all the segments have to be Lie-like, so they are either like this or like this. And you have to go down, up, etc. So this configuration is parameterized by n x plus I coordinates, so this, 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 and so on, and n x minus I coordinates. So this configuration is completely labeled by n x plus coordinates and n x minus coordinates. Now, from these 2n quantities, you can construct 2n minus 6 invariant cross ratios. The way of counting these 2n minus 6, there are different ways. One way is you have 2n, because it's n minus plus n, but then you have the isometry group or the conformal group in two dimensions, that is SO2,2, that has 6 generators. So you get 2n minus 6. This will be important to remember. So like scattering in two dimensions of 2n particles has 2n minus 6 cross ratios. Okay, so now we want to consider the strings that end on this kind of polygon. So we need to consider classical strings on ADS3. Any questions?
Before I proceed. So we didn't do much.
We gave you the way of constructing amplitudes at a strong coupling. This has to do with computing some minimal surfaces in ADS5. We are not smart enough to consider ADS5, so we are considering a simplified problem in ADS3.
This is ADS3. So the boundary is two-dimensional.
Boundary, yes, but I thought, don't you have, course, you were talking before, Y0, Y1, in picture is four.
That's correct, so it's a little bit.
Two, so you have three coordinates.
That's true, it's not so easy to see. So basically,
you can see this in a lot of different ways, and all of them are related by conformal transformations. Now, if you do this, and then you try to write this worksheet in embedding coordinates, you will see that in embedding coordinates, y3 and y4 are equal 0. So if you are in embedding coordinate, these last two coordinates here are 0. So you have ABS3. That's correct, yeah. Well, they have something to do. There is some transformation. That's correct. Because they are related by a conformal transformation.
All the ones you're saying by zero is the function of y1 and y2.
Yes.
You're excluding it and you're talking about y1 and y2.
If you want. Yes. Yeah, so this is a worksheet. So it's a two-dimensional worksheet.
I understand now.
Right. So actually, there are different ways to see this.
In some ways, it's better to see this as, if you want, what I am saying is the following. Notice that if you use this and this, you could use this to rewrite R instead of in terms of y0, y1, and y2. So you are in ADS4, y1, y2, y0, and R, but you have one constraint. So what I am saying is that if you focus on these kind of configurations, you also will have one constraint between these coordinates. And this constraint allows you to consider ADS3 instead of ADS4. Yeah, maybe I should have said that more clearly. No. I mean, like, I guess you play, you just play. I mean, you can see the equations of motion. Then you can just see that, well, there is, so basically, well, so basically here, you see that there is some quadratic constraint between R and Y0. So this quadratic constraint, well, you can work it out, but it's something like R square is equal like Y1 square plus 2Y2 square minus Y0 square plus 1. Or something like that. Then you can see that this constraint, if you come here, is true given the fact that you touch the unit circle. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so, or you can see at the level of the equations of motion, just you see that if you consider this configuration, then you can set y3 and y4 equals 0.
Defining a polygon.
No, it has to do, because if the equations of motion are not consistent with putting these two things to 0.
Is it just boundary?
Both things. I mean, like, The boundary, from this picture, you can see that the boundary conditions are consistent with setting this from the picture. Now, the fact that the equations of motion are also consistent with this is a non-trivial fact. And for that, you have to see the two equations of motion and see that once you have set these, the two reduce to the same equations of motion. So that is what is not so easy to picture. So we consider classical strings on ADS3.
Now, what are classical strings on ADS3? So first, let's start writing ADS3 in terms of embedding coordinates, y1, y2, y0, and y-1. And each of these y's is function of c and c bar. And these c and c bar are the worksheet coordinates. Then you have to satisfy the equations of motion, the conformal gauge equations of motion. And as we are talking about string theory, these equations of motion have to be supplemented with the Virasoro constraint. So you have four variables with this constraint satisfying these two conditions. Now, there is a very nice way to solve automatically these two conditions, and it's by performing a so-called Paul-Meyer reduction. So you start with a solution of classical strings on ADS3, and you write two fields, alpha, that is a function of C and C bar, and P, that is this complicated stuff here. Now, it turns out that the equations of motion and the Virasoro constraints imply two things. First, this P is just a holomorphic function. It's just a function of C. It's not a function of CC bar. And second, this alpha satisfies the generalized Sinch-Gordon equation. So we started with three fields. We ended up with a field and a half. So it's like quite good. Now, notice, well, I want to mention two little things. So first, this alpha and p are invariant under this SO2,4 conformal transformations. That's quite nice because it means that we will focus only in the interesting part of the problem. We will not focus on conformal, not invariant things. Second, you can compute the area of the worksheet. It's just you start with the conformal gauge action, and you write it in terms of the reduced fields. And this is simply the integral of e to the 2 alpha. Okay. So now one can ask a different question. So suppose that I give you a solution of the generalized Sinch-Gordon equation. I give you one p and one alpha. Can you construct a solution of strings on ADS3? And there is a very well-known procedure. So from these fields alpha and p, you construct flat connections that we will call b left and b right. And then we solve two linear auxiliary problems that are as follows. It's very hard to show directly. You can prove from the equations of motion and Virasoro that this quantity is holomorphic, but it's not very trivial. So you solve these two auxiliary linear problems. This A runs from 1 to 2. So the connections look very simple in terms of this alpha and p. And then it turns out that the space-time coordinates are simply some quadratic, some bilinear form of these two solutions. This M is simply the identity matrix. And one can indeed check that this Y has all the correct properties. So what we said, given a solution of strings on ADS3, we can construct these fields P and alpha. And given P and alpha, you can construct a solution of strings on ADS3. Any questions before I proceed? That's correct. I mean, if I give you alpha, in principle, you can think about trying to solve the linear problem. So there are two, we will have many problems. One of the problems will be to find alpha. And once you find alpha, you have to solve the linear problem, in principle. So that indeed. For whom? Well, it depends very much. Now you will see we will find some alphas. Yes. Okay, so one thing in a couple of minutes that I would like to remark is an interesting connection. Now, you don't need to understand the next 2 or 3 minutes if you don't want. But there is a nice connection to the so-called Hitching equations. These Hitching writes difficult papers, but these equations are not very fancy. So they are simply the self-dual Yanni-Mills equations from reduced down to 2 dimensions. So 4-dimensional, sorry, pure Yanni-Mills self-dual equations reduced to 2 dimensions. So in that reduction, you interpret the two first components of the gauge field as a 2-dimensional gauge field, And then from the 3 and 4 components, we create, we do a complex Higgs field. Then it turns out that these 4-dimensional equations, the self-duality equations, imply this set of equations that are called the Hitching equations. Now, we can come back to our connections, to these connections, and we can decompose them into diagonal and off-diagonal parts. And it turns out that the flatness condition for this B, that is this, implies exactly the Hitching equations. So we have a particular solution of the SU2 Hitching equations. That I don't think I will cover today, but that will be eventually useful for all what we do. Okay, so let's come back now to your question and see how we construct solutions, etc. So what we said was that classical solutions on a DS3 are equivalent to a couple of fields, P and alpha. It's just because they are 2x2 matrices.
It could be other, but not our case. So in our case, we have just 2x2 matrices.
So there's no deep connection in general description, just accident?
Well, I don't think it's just an accident. We use this quite heavily later on. We can talk later. But, yeah, it's just accidental. So notice that if we have these two fields,
P and alpha, we can go to a new variable. Instead of the C variable, we can go to the W variable, defined as follows. So it's the square root of PC DC. And we can shift the field alpha to some field alpha hat. And then this field alpha hat, when written in the W coordinates, will satisfy the usual Singe-Gordon equation. Of course, notice that C is in general a complex plane, but W will not be a complex plane because this P will be some complicated function. So we can have either a simple equation in a complicated field, or we can have a complicated equation just in the complex plane. Now, okay, we are talking too much and doing too little. So we need somehow to get some intuition on what this P and alpha can be for the solutions that we are interested in. So what we can do then is to take the square solution, that is the solution we have, to perform this Paul-Meyer reduction and try to find P and alpha. So what we find is that this P of C is equal to 1, and this alpha hat is equal to 0. So what took us like 6-7 months of work was just a trivial solution of this Singe-Gordon equation. So in that case, alpha hat is equal to 0, and this P is equal to 1. Now, from this, we get inspired, and then we say, okay, so maybe for solutions relevant to scattering amplitudes, we require PC to be a polynomial, and this alpha hat to decay at infinity. The reason why we ask alpha hat to decay at infinity is because, remember that the infinity in the complex plane corresponds to the boundary of the worksheet, and we want cusps. So we want the solution to be similar to the cusp solution, to the 4-cusp solution. So that is what we will require in general, P to be some polynomial and alpha hat to decay at infinity. That's a very good question. Actually, we were confused like a week between that.
So it turns out to be alpha hat. So, like, once you construct explicit solutions, you see that this works. But yeah, at this point, it could be anything. Yeah. So now, in the last 5 minutes, do I have 5 minutes or so? Yeah, I will not cover all, but I want to
show you the following. So consider a generic polynomial of degree n minus 2. So a generic polynomial, you can write as follows, c to the n minus 2 plus 0, c to the n minus 3, plus some coefficient to the n minus 4, etc. And notice that we have fixed the first coefficient to 1 and the second coefficient to 0 by using rescalings and translations in the C-plane. So we can always do that. Then, for a polynomial of degree n minus 2, we are left with n minus 3 complex coefficients, or 2n minus 6 real variables. But 2n minus 6 is exactly the quantity of cross ratios that you had in two dimensions in the scattering of 2n gluons. So what we would like to claim is that if you consider the scattering, this particular two-dimensional scattering or null Wilson loops of 2n sides, then you end up with some field alpha and a polynomial of degree n minus 2. And this counting agrees with that. Now, the simplest case is the case in which this polygon is just some homogeneous function, so it's just c to the n minus 2. And one can see that in that case, it is consistent in the generalized Sinch-Gordon equation to require this alpha to be a function only on the radial coordinate of mod of c. So in that case, the Sinch-Gordon equation simplifies a lot and reduces to the so-called Pine-Levé 3 type of equation. So in that case, the linear problem is quite simple, and we can solve the inverse map, the map that I show you today, and you can see that the solution has a CN symmetry and corresponds to a regular polygon. So it corresponds to the case in which this projection is exactly a regular polygon of 2n sides. So this tells us that we are doing things not so wrongly, and that indeed a polynomial of degree n minus 2 corresponds to something with 2n cusps. So how many minutes do I have?
Well, there is another little question I will try to go quickly, and it's how do you compute the area? So suppose now that you have this this solution corresponding to this classical, to these regular polygons, and you have to compute the area, so the integral of e to the 2 alpha or e to the 2 alpha hat dw in the other variables. We do a very smart thing. We subtract one and we add one. So remember that alpha hat at infinity goes to 0. So this integral here is convergent, because this decays exponentially at infinity. While this is a divergent answer. Now, given that we have solved the inverse map, we can regularize this integral here. And we get, for instance, with dimensional regularization, we get the expected answer for the infrared divergences of a regular polygon with 2n sides. On the other hand, we have to focus on this. That is the interesting part. And now it turns out that this exactly the same integral was considered by Samolochko, studying two-dimensional polymers on a cylinder. And he considered this, and he studied a lot of things, and working a little bit from his result, you can extract the answer for generic n. So we get exactly this plus this. So that is the full answer. A little check that one can do, and this is my last slide, is notice that if you have a regular polygon of n size, right, like 4, 8, and so on, and you make the number of sides to 10 to infinity, then you get a circular Wilson loop. And the results for the circular Wilson loop were known and you can take the n equals infinity limit of this, and you get some divergent term that we throw, and you get this minus 2 pi, and this minus 2 pi is exactly in agreement with the circular Wilson loop results that people has found before. So this is the result for the, I will not, sorry. The divergent piece is, you mean this divergent piece or the other? I don't know if you're aware with the computation of Wilson loops at a strong coupling. Well, when you compute Wilson loops at a strong coupling, there is a divergent term that is proportional to the perimeter. So when you compute the expectation value for the circular Wilson loop, you get the perimeter over epsilon minus 2 pi. So here the perimeter would be this n. So our perimeter is n somehow. So we throw that away and we compare the two finite pieces. Now one can consider this case, but I will not, don't worry. And there the connection to Hitchin equations is much more important. But okay, I can discuss it privately. I think I can end up here. Thank you very much.
Question?
That's a very good question. So, yeah, that I think is one of the. So, first, something that I didn't stress, maybe, is the following. Is that when you compute an amplitude at a strong coupling, the answer is quite universal. By that, I mean that this exponential behavior is true for MHB and non-MHB. It's actually true either if you scatter gluons or you scatter fermions or scalars. So this is completely universal. On the other hand, one can have a prefactor here. This prefactor will be subleading in 1 over the square root of lambda, and you should be able to compute that if you introduce loop corrections, like 1 over the square root of lambda corrections to all to what I have said. And there you should see the helicity dependence of this scattering amplitude. That would be very interesting, but I don't know how to do that. But in particular, you should see that if all the helicities are all pluses, then this prefactor here should be zero, and so on. So that, that will enter as subleading corrections in 1 over the square root of lambda.
Can you prove that this prefactor is non-zero for non-HB?
No, it may be some accident that makes it zero. Yeah, I mean, even if it is zero, it doesn't matter actually, because of the following. So what I am saying is that the answer at a strong coupling looks something like that, right? So it's some E square root of lambda times the area, and then some prefactor 1 plus P2 over square root of lambda plus P3 over lambda. So I expect this structure. So even if P1 is zero, P2 may be not zero. Right. So by doing a one loop computation, you would be able to compute this P1. But then you would have all the. So I am not sure whether this will be some nice prefactor times. So this in principle will depend on the helicities.
P1 can come with factors of lambda, and you can have zero more.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
You made a very strong statement about the universality of this with respect to both gluons and then masses. Is that a proven statement, or is that the number of difficulties initially in this work with massive external states?
Right. Well, for n equals 4, I would expect it to be the case. It's quite strong, but I mean, the point is that basically you have the ADS 5 versus 5 sigma model. And if you are at really strong coupling, a lot of details of that model doesn't matter. for instance, you focus only in the ADS part and not on the S5. So you don't look at excitations in the whole model, but just on a part of them. The fermions don't enter. So I think that is, I don't know whether to say that it has been proven, but I would expect to go through.
You don't know that it hasn't been proven, right?
Well, I would expect it. I mean, I would expect this to be true. On the other hand, there are a lot of things I didn't say. So one does, when you approximate an amplitude by a classical action, you are doing saddle point approximations. So one should verify whether this saddle point is good or not. Amit and McGreevy have done some studies and things. Okay, but I mean, yeah. But you are doing some assumptions that I expect them to be true, but it depends how rigorous. Now, what do you call a proof? On the other hand, we haven't found the classical solutions. So some, like for four gluons, I expect this to be true because you find the solution and integrates with the VDS ansatz, and there you have a lot of control.
Okay, well, Nando's here till Friday lunch.
Yes.
Thank you for having us. Thank him again for being here.